Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395.
Muslim pilgrims are converging on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala to mark Arba'in, the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. Russia says the expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine crosses its red line. And British fuel stations have run dry across major English cities as the government blames panic buying for the country's deepening supply chain crisis. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. Muslims across the world have marked Arba'in, which is the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. Every year, Iran is home to mourning processions to mark the occasion, but this year, the coronavirus pandemic has imposed restrictions on travel to Iraq to commemorate the occasion. Salman Kudri reports.
Muslims marked Arba'in, the 40th day that followed the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the third Shia Imam and his 72 strong companions in the Battle of Karbala in what is now southern Iraq in 680 AD. Each year, millions of Muslim mourners set out on a symbolic 80-kilometer-long walk that begins from the holy city of Najaf in Iraq, where Imam Hussein's father Imam Ali's shrine is located, to the holy city of Karbala that houses Imam Hussein's shrine. But this year, due to COVID-19 pandemic, Iraq has imposed restrictions on the number of pilgrims. According to Iranian officials, nearly 60,000 Iranian pilgrims have traveled to Iraq to partake in the huge annual Arba'in procession. The Arba'in march is of great significance for Muslims. In Iran, those who cannot make it to Karbala take part in a symbolic march from Tehran to the town of Ray towards the holy shrine of Hazrat Abdulazim Hassani.
Arba'in march is one of the largest religious gatherings in the world, which manifests the extent of the age-old love for Imam Hussein and his ideology of resistance against injustice. This year, although the COVID-19 pandemic has either cancelled or restricted most of the mourning processions, our love for Imam Hussein runs deep in our hearts and will never fade away.
The love for Imam Hussein runs in our family. My family and I always take part in such religious ceremonies to remember Imam Hussein, because with his sacrifice, he saved the true Islam. Still after 14 centuries, we honor him as a savior of our religion, and he's the best role model for me and my children.
Over the past decade, the Iranian and Iraqi people have begun participating in what came to be known as the Great Walk of Arba'in, a procession during which millions of Iranian and Iraqi Shias travel on foot to the shrine city of Karbala, south of Iraq, to renew allegiance with the ideals and teachings of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. The Battle of Karbala featured an unjust fight between Imam Hussein and his army and the hugely outnumbered army of the Umayyad Caliph of the time, Yazid.
The Day of Arba'in is a day on which the family members of Imam Hussein return to the plain of Karbala to properly bid farewell to their fallen heroes and finally grieve for their loved ones. Salman Kujurib, Tehran.
Wassam Bahrani joined us earlier with more details on the Arba'in commemoration taking place in Iraq's holy city of Karbala.
I think it's also important to highlight the security services that have been provided for this pilgrimage. At least between 20 to 25,000 people have been officials have announced that 20 and 25,000 have military armed personnel are protecting this pilgrimage, which has been subject to terrorist takfiri attacks in the past. The majority of those 20 to 25,000 are from the popular mobilization units. The most vital, important component of Iraq's armed forces that has defended Iraqi sovereignty and continues to its attempts to continuing to protect Iraq's sovereignty. In addition to the health facilities, the health services, the medical sector, they haven't let the pilgrims down. Again, very wide variety of medical services have been provided by both Iraqi and foreign pilgrims. Iranian doctors we've seen along the way providing health services to the pilgrims, as well as foreign, the Iraqis are known for their hospitality as well. Foreign people have brought food with them, the foreign pilgrims, and set up their caravans, set up their centers to provide food for the pilgrims. We've seen a lot of Iranians handing out food.
Moscow says the expansion of NATO's military activity in Ukraine crosses a red line for the Russian President Vladimir Putin. The Kremlin spokesman said that Russia and Belarus will act to protect their own security. Earlier in the day, the Belarusian president warned of a joint response with Russia to the increased activity of the Western military alliance in Ukraine. Alexander Lukashenko accused the U.S. of setting up military training centers in Ukraine, which he said amount to military bases. Kyiv started joint military exercises with the U.S. and other NATO nations last week, while Moscow and Minsk held large-scale drills in Russia, Belarus, and the Baltic Sea. Ukraine is not a NATO member, but has been seeking closer integration with Western militaries. Ukraine says one of its soldiers has been killed and another injured in renewed clashes in the country's volatile east. The Ukrainian army accused pro-Russian fighters of launching 6 attacks on its troops in the span of 24 hours. The country's eastern Donbas region has been locked in clashes between government forces and pro-Russian fighters over the past 6 years. Kyiv accuses Russia of supporting and arming anti-Ukraine fighters along its border, but Moscow has repeatedly denied the allegation. A ceasefire was brokered in Minsk in 2015, but has failed to end the fighting in Ukraine. 9 years ago, on September 26, Press TV correspondent in Syria Maya Nasser was killed by terrorist groups while covering an attack in Damascus. As his colleagues say, Nasser represented the core meaning of war journalism, sacrificing his life for the sake of truth. Our correspondent Mohammed Ali has more from the Syrian capital.
On the 26th of September 2012, Press TV correspondent Maya Nasser rushed in the early hours of the morning to cover a terrorist attack on the Ministry of Defense in Damascus, driven by his passion for journalism and determination to report the truth. He was shot dead by terrorists as soon they saw the cameras. His cameraman, Ali, said he never forgets the moment Maya died on his shoulder with a peaceful smile on his face.
When I and Maya arrived at the entrance of the defense ministry, terrorists threw grenades at us. We took shelter in a barrack. They opened gunfire at us as they saw on camera. He was shot dead in the neck and chest. I only realized what happened when his head lied on my shoulder with a smile on his face.
Maya was polite with high morale. He was cooperative with our team. He was able to turn the pressures and negative aspects of war into positive energy. He was kind in his relations with his colleagues in the office.
Maya was not the first journalist who sacrificed his life for conveying the truth in Syria. The impact of losing a family member on front lines is never easy for family members. Maya's father says he is armed with patience and love to his homeland, which his son died in its defense.
The homeland is more precious than anything in the world. I wish I was in Maya's place that day. I thank God for everything. We are armed with the sacrifices of our martyrs and patience of their families. We look forward for a more beautiful homeland, free of problems and free of enemies.
Maya was originally from Homs province in Syria. His career as a journalist lasted for a few months back in 2012. But his devotion, honesty, resistance, sacrifice, and professionalism were clear in his reporting, which was mainly from Damascus and Aleppo. 9 years have passed since Maya was martyred, yet he is still remembered by his family members, friends, and colleagues as a symbol of sacrifice on the path of truth and resistance. And on behalf of Maya, I, Muhammad Ali, am honored to conclude this report by saying, Maya Nasser, Damascus.
The UK's Petrol Retailers Association warns that gas stations are running dry across the land as panic buying continues throughout British stations. The association, which represents independent fuel retailers, said that some big groups in English cities are reporting that 50% to 90% of pumps were dry. A dire shortage of truck drivers in Britain has triggered panic buying in some English cities. The panic buying forced the government to suspend competition laws and allow firms to work together to ease shortages. Worker shortages are a growing problem in Britain, which had a record 1 million job vacancies between June and August. Tehran has dismissed as biased and false It claimed by the International Atomic Energy Agency that it was barred from a nuclear site in Iran. Spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Behruz Kamalbandi, also warned IAEA against disrupting the cooperation with the Islamic Republic. On Sunday, the agency said its inspectors had been denied access to a centrifuge manufacturing site in the city of Karaj, near the capital, Tehran. Iran says the facility is exempt from an understanding reached with IAEA earlier this month over servicing, monitoring, and surveillance equipment at Iranian nuclear sites. Russia also says denying the agency access to the site does not violate safeguards agreements. Iranian officials say the Karaj site was sabotaged in an attack in June, which is still being investigated by security and judicial authorities. The Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya has called for international action to protect his people against the Israeli killing machine.
Firstly, the Council of Ministers condemns Israel's assassination of five Palestinian youth in northern Jerusalem and Jenin, and previously in Beita and everywhere else, and calls for international action for the protection of our people in the face of the Israeli killing machine.
Shataya made the comments one day after Israeli forces killed five Palestinians in overnight raids across the occupied West Bank. The killings also drew angry reactions from Palestinian groups, which pledged to push ahead with their anti-Israeli resistance. The Islamic Hamas movement also condemned the killings and called on the Palestinian Authority to end its security cooperation with Tel Aviv and meetings with Israeli officials. Earlier, our West Bank correspondent Mona Kandil gave us more details on the reactions to Israel's latest killings of Palestinians.
Hamas movement as well issued a statement condemning the ongoing crimes against the people of Palestine, saying that all the Palestinians are one and that the Israeli forces do not differentiate between any Palestinian or a group and another. President Mahmoud Abbas, or the office of the Palestinian president, slammed the killing of those Palestinian youths, and today, at the beginning of the Palestinian ministers' meeting, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh called for an international intervention in order to force Israel to stop committing crimes against the people of Palestine, especially that the Israelis, under the justification looking for Palestinians wanted for so-called security reasons, they continue to illegally raid the Palestinian areas. They continue to arrest people on a daily basis, regardless if they women, men, elderly, or even children. They continue to oppress the people here.
Moving on, Germany's conservative Christian Democrats say that they still intend to form a coalition government even after the rival Social Democrats narrowly won the country's general election.
The Federal Board of the CDU Executive Committee is in agreement that we are prepared to enter into talks for a Jamaica coalition. The people who voted for CDU-CSU want us to take responsibility and govern, and we are convinced that a government under the leadership of the union CDU-CSU is the best thing for Germany, and we have a responsibility to these voters.
Armin Laschet made the comments in a press conference, noting that his party is ready to form a coalition with the Greens and Free Democrats. He underlined that no one should act as if they alone can decide on the formation of a government. Laschet also took responsibility for his party's poor election results and vowed, quote, the renewal in all areas. Following the country's federal elections, the leaders of Germany's political parties met on Monday to kick off coalition negotiations that could take months. The retired United States Army Colonel and former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell says that Israel will not survive the next 20 years as Tel Aviv is doing what it is to itself as an apartheid regime. This is quite a statement coming from a former U.S. official who held the post of Chief of Staff. But what would prompt him to take such a stance towards America's closest ally, Israel?
Retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is the former Chief of Staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, who emerged as a leading critic of the New Conservatives. New Conservatives are characterized by their support of hawkish foreign policies. In remarks to Mass Peace Action last June, he made some brazen assertions about Israel.
I said the other day Israel would not be a state in 20 years. It'd be gone. It certainly would not be a democracy. It'll be an apartheid state. And the world will just reject reject it, as they did South Africa. But I'm now saying it probably won't be a state. It'll be gone.
He pointed to the 1946 Joint Chiefs of Staff to a State War Navy Coordinating Committee, noting that then U.S. President Harry Truman was trying at the time to decide whether to recognize Israel in 1947-48 and what to do about U.S. policy. Wilkerson said, Israel is a strategic liability of the first order for the United States, and the chances are very high it would drag Washington's feet into a full-fledged face-off. The retired general also revealed that during 40 years of military service, he had heard constant advice from everyone not to establish an American military base in the Israeli-occupied territories. He stressed that the United States standing with Israel against half of the world is not a good thing. The Israeli regime, he said, needs to be reined, but that would not happen.
Israel, I think, needs to be reined in, and it needs to be told in no uncertain terms, you will change, and you will change swiftly and effectively, or you can count your sugar daddy gone. Yeah, not going to happen. Not going to happen.
In fact, Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel for decades through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes.
Well, I certainly think that that's a possibility. I do agree that it is delegitimizing itself, even in the eyes of many Jews around the world, especially young Jews, which is going to make it hard, of course, for Israel to reproduce itself. And yes, I think it's being considered more and more a worldwide pariah.
But Lawrence Wilkerson also said the neoconservative agenda in the Middle East was to set the Levant on fire, to keep Israel's enemies so at one another's throats, that they could not give Israel any trouble. However, one way that plan failed was the formation and continued existence of the Axis of Resistance, proving all of those plots to have failed.
Wilkerson has said that the obsession of U.S. neoconservatives, particularly former Vice President Dick Cheney and former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, is to plunge the entire Middle East region into chaos and to keep Israel's enemies at each other's throats so that they could not unite and give Israel trouble, militarily or otherwise. Wilkerson also pointed out that it does not matter for neoconservatives to target Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, or Iran in their pursuit to set the region on fire, as the important thing for them is to protect Israel. However, the Axis of Resistance in the region has so far managed to oppose Western, namely United States and Israel, interests in the region and foiled their plots. Members of the Axis of Resistance include Iran, Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, to name a few. The latest sign of this assertion is the U.S. House of Representatives' decision to pass a bill to provide $1 billion of additional funding to replenish Israel's so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system, despite the regime's blatant violation of Palestinian human rights.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Environmental activists, many of them school students taking time out from school, stage rallies around the world on Friday, 24th of September, to demand that leaders take stronger action to curb climate change amid dire warnings of an increasingly hotter globe if nothing is done soon. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Associated Press. The piece is titled, Activists Stage Global Rallies Over Climate Change. Environmental activists, many of them school pupils and students taking time out from school, stage rallies around the world on Friday, 24th of September, to demand that leaders take stronger action to curb climate change amid dire warnings of an increasingly hotter globe if nothing is done soon. The issue has climbed the political agenda in many countries as scientists are warning that the world faces dangerous temperature rises unless greenhouse gas emissions are cut sharply in the coming years. Swedish teenage environmental activist Greta Thunberg took part in a protest in Berlin, Germany, just a few days before the German election, in which climate change has been a major topic. The Swedish activist, whose solo strike in 2018 inspired the global Fridays for Future movement, told cheering supporters they needed to keep up the pressure on Germany's political leaders past election day. Greta Thunberg told a crowd in Berlin of more than 100,000 people that no political party was doing enough. Yes, we must vote. You must vote. But remember that voting only will not be enough. We must keep going into the streets, she said. The issue has also topped the agenda in Iceland, which heads to the polls for general election on Saturday. All parties running for seats in the North Atlantic Island Nations Parliament acknowledge global warming as a force of change in a sub-Arctic landscape, but disagree on how to respond to it. Global climate protests were muted during the coronavirus pandemic due to restrictions on public gatherings. But with many countries relaxing rules again, thousands of people are expected on the streets of Berlin, Germany, in Milan, Italy, and many other large cities throughout the world. Hundreds of thousands of people in 99 countries have taken part in a coordinated global climate strike demanding urgent action to tackle the ecological crisis. The strike, which took place on Friday, 24th of September, the first worldwide climate action since the coronavirus pandemic hit, is taking place weeks before the COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, United Kingdom. Large crowds protested in many countries, including in Seoul, South Korea, in Kodaira, just west of Tokyo, Japan, and also in Milan, Italy. Organizers of the global event said there were protests in more than 1,800 towns and cities around the world, with large events taking place in Europe, Africa, in North and Southern America. In Mexico, protesters assembled in front of the National Palace in Mexico City to demand that the state oil company Pemex present a plan to decarbonize. While in Bangladesh, activists demanded the scrapping of planned new coal and gas-powered electricity-generating power stations. In South Africa, demonstrations took place in 12 cities as part of a three-day strike to demand the South African government oversee a just transition from fossil fuels. In London, England, protesters gathered outside the House of Commons to hear speakers call on the UK government to do more to meet its climate goals. Large demonstrations also took place in Canada, Brazil, and Argentina. Earlier this year, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, said the world's carbon emissions must fall by half by 2030 to keep global heating below 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, the limit that countries agreed to strive for in the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. But the United Nations reported on 17th of September that current pledges from countries would lead to a 16% rise in the next decade. There have been some positive moves in recent days, with China saying it will end its financing of highly polluting coal-powered power stations abroad, and the United States doubling its climate finance to vulnerable nations.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
membership has happened. After holding the observer state status since the year 2005, Iran has become a permanent member of the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. What will that mean for the bloc, and will this bloc, with Iran's addition, stand up to the West, in particular when it comes to trade and security? Hi, I'm Kavit Ahwai. Coming up in today's program, the SCO, a regional organization in the heart of Asia, whose members account for 1/5 of the global GDP, 2/5 of the world's population, and 3/5 of the Eurasian landmass. Now, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, on his first maiden foreign trip, was welcomed with SCO membership. Not a bad start. Countering sanctions and increasing trade now more likely for the country. Also coming up in this program, does the SCO now spell a concern for the U.S.? That is something the U.S. needs to think of. Is this the end of U.S. unilateralism? Now the SCO has Iran, China, and Russia on its list, all targeted by the U.S. through sanctions and maximum pressure policy. Has the U.S.-China containment received a blow? A regional organization in the heart of Asia, whose members account for 1/5 of the global GDP, 2/5 of the world's population, and 3/5 of the Eurasian landmass. Such is the combined value of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization's 9 full members: China, India, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan, Russia, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and now Iran.
Iran, Saeed Ibrahim Raisi.
The group did have 4 observers: Mongolia, Afghanistan, Belarus, and Iran, but Iran is no longer part of that grouping. And the SCO has started procedures to admit Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Qatar as new dialogue partners. Given the enormous extent of geographical coverage, amounting to 35 million square kilometers, and a population as high as 3.15 billion people, the organization has been known to be the greatest producer and the greatest consumer of energy at the same time on a global scale. Over its 20-year existence, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has been mostly seen as a forum for security cooperation to combat extremism, separatism, and terrorism. But now trade and banking are more dominant concerns. China and other members of the SCO have made considerable economic and commercial progress in the last 20 years. Annual trade volume has increased by 20 times in 2020. A favorable environment for trade and investments, and achieving free flow of goods, capitals, services, and technologies, especially in the post-era of the COVID-19 pandemic, has become more of a priority issue. These have all been stipulated in the organization's charter. The process of expansion for the SCO was a natural outcome for the organization, waiting to happen. But this occurred years ago, and it appears more nations will follow. Russia and China are the economic powerhouses of the SCO. Some achievements of that organization is that its total GDP reached $16.6 trillion in the year 2017, while approaching EU's $17.1 trillion US dollars and accounting for almost 25%, close to 21% actually, of global GDP. Well, the SCO is expected to surpass the US in the year 2022. And by 2022, China's total economy will be around $15 trillion, and the proportion of SCO's economies will reach about 26%. So that says quite a lot. Well, joining us for this segment, we have André Loing. He is an international and independent China strategist. He's had decades of experience as a senior Hong Kong government official in a variety of fields, including finance, industry, social welfare, and overseas representation. André, welcome. The SCO countries, some of the stats, covering 1/4 of the Earth's land and nearly half of the human population, a regional organization in the heart of Asia, members accounting for 1/5 of the global GDP, 2/5 of the world's population, and 3/5 of Eurasian landmass. What is the economic capacity of this organization, and has it reached its full potential?
Well, of course, in the organization, the role of China and the economic size of China overshadows everything else. Don't forget that in a different organization called the BRICS, China, Brazil, Russia, and India, China's economy is the sum total, is bigger than the sum total of the rest combined. As you rightly pointed out, the organization has been pushing below its weight. But I think the time has come for the organization to adopt a much larger role with the change in Afghanistan.
Okay, thank you for that. We appreciate it, Andre. Let's now take a look at more information about the SCO. It's a lot that encompasses this grouping of countries, and the next piece will enlighten you on that. It's time now for our Info News section of the program. This is where we try to focus on economic news and social news that usually don't make it into mainstream media. Now, our first story occurs in the UK. The headline read, UK empty shelves, a crisis that isn't just down to COVID-19 and Brexit. It's been decades in the making. Now, that's something that many perhaps are not aware of. It went on to say that ever worsening conditions in supply chain jobs have made Britain's shortages inevitable, and a pay rise for lorry drivers won't end them. Now, you combine that with a labor crisis, you bet the UK is worried. Next up, we go to the US. 9 million Americans just got the rug pulled out from under them when enhanced pandemic federal unemployment benefits expired there. Now, workers in this country aren't lacking work ethics. They're saying they simply don't have reliable child care, health care, or economic infrastructure to support them in times of crises. Now, while this has happened, COVID-19 is still raging on in that country, so pulling the benefits from these Americans is not coming at a good time. Moving on to China, officially applying to the Asia-Pacific Free Trade Pact, the CPTPP was it joined that, and it inked it in 2018. You had 11 countries, including Australia, Canada, Chile, Japan, and New Zealand, that joined it, which in the accord represent nearly 500 million consumers, accounting for 13.3% of the global GDP. Now, the trade agreement is essentially an updated version of the ill-fated Trans-Pacific Partnership, if you remember that. Finally, we go to Sri Lanka. A state of emergency declared there. There's an economic slump. There are food shortages in that country, so bad that the military was deployed to stop the citizens hoarding food amidst shortages of essential goods. The prices of food, including rice, milk, and cereals, have tripled in some areas due to inflation, while many shelves in the government-run supermarkets in the capital, Colombo, are empty. This is our in-depth section where we take a deeper look at today's topic, SCO's economic perspective. Now, in order to get an idea about where the SCO stands compared to the rest of the world, that's our main focus now, let us take a look at this map. Now, this map here is a breakdown of the SCO in terms of the ones that are members, which is in red, the ones who are observers, that's in orange, and the ones who are attendants, they call it attendants. And you can see those members, which are comprised in those three categories. China, India, and Russia, for example, are three of the major members. Of course, Iran, as you can see over here, Iran now is a permanent member, something that obviously is a milestone, because Iran had the observer status since the year 2005. Now, the ones remaining in that grouping are Mongolia, Afghanistan, and Belarus. Also noteworthy is to talk about the dialogue partners, which Turkey is in that grouping. And then, more importantly, you have another development. SCO has started procedures to admit Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Qatar as new dialogue partners. So it's noteworthy to mention that here. Now, our guest Andre Long talked about the China Belt and Road Initiative. Take a look at this. It's good to have your memories refreshed if you haven't taken a look at this. This is basically the China's Belt and Road Initiative, which represents Chinese President Xi Jinping's grand vision, which obviously starts from China, for example. And you have the breakdown in the colors. Black are the land routes that from China goes all the way through and is a gateway covering countries like Pakistan, like Iran, all the way through to Turkey, and it's a gateway to Europe. And then you have the maritime networks, which start again from China, for example, from Fuzhou, port there in the green. These are all the different ports that it encompasses in this Belt and Road Initiative. Again, Iran being one of the major connecting points between the Far East and then into going into Europe. So you can see how that regional integration is what's important. It increases trade and it stimulates economic growth. Okay, now the Polar Silk Road, usually not mentioned in the Silk Road Initiative by China. This is the Polar Silk Road, this one area in the black, which goes around all the way through on top of Russia, which leads onto Europe. So you can see this is very important. Again, something that's not mentioned is called the Polar Silk Roads. And again, the Belt and Road Initiative, important because it's a gateway to Europe and beyond. And these are the others that we just covered in the previous map, which are the maritime routes and, of course, the land routes. So I want to now shock you with an old map. The world divided in half. You got the western side, and then you have the eastern side. The eastern side comprised of Africa, for example, West Asia, and Asia. It was the center of global trade in terms of economic activity. Gives you an idea about the way that the trade volume way in the past was focused in this area and in this region of the world. Now, these facts cannot be ignored. We're going to talk about now the facts about the SCO in terms of what it comprises. Over 60% of the world's land mass covers the SCO countries cover, and this is a leading institution that says that. More than one-third of the world's population, again, a very important fact, to give you a depth about the SCO. Also, we need to mention how it has nearly 45% of the world's energy reserves. Again, very important. And also, it's a combined economy that nearly equals the U.S. gross domestic product. So the SCO, when you take a look at those figures, has significant influence over the world's economy and security. Moreover, the SCO is an organization exclusive of the U.S., which may potentially threaten U.S.'s security and interests. So this question can't be ignored. Shouldn't the U.S. be concerned by the SCO? Now, for a breakdown, professor and political analyst with an economic flair, Mohammed Mirandi, joins us. He's a lecturer at the University of Tehran, and he's appeared on numerous media outlets, such as Al Jazeera, such as RT, and also we can mention TRT World. And he joins us now to give us his insight and analysis on this. Professor Mirandi, welcome. The SCO meeting this year has admitted Iran, finally. And this admission, you tweeted that Iran's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is another major setback for the U.S. regime. It shows that the U.S. did not have enough influence to convince a single government to block Iran's entry. It's also good news for all of Iran's allies. Can or does the SCO, now Iran has joined it, have the ability to stand up to the West? And will the SCO be able to economically, through trade, stand up to the West?
Well, SCO countries collectively are more powerful than Western countries. And as the balance of power tilts away from Western countries, I think Asia will become even more powerful, comparatively speaking, than today in the near future. The United States and its allies have antagonized Iran, Russia, China, and other countries. They are the ones who've created so many adversaries for themselves because they want to be the hegemon over global affairs. And now that they've done this, now that they've antagonized so many countries, this has created an enormous incentive for countries that are constantly being attacked by the United States to cooperate more than before. So three important countries, China, Russia, and Iran, which have confronted American imperial ambitions and have been on the receiving end of U.S. hostility, they are moving closer together, and the SCO provides an opportunity to even strengthen that convergence even further.
The 21st meeting of the Council of Heads of States of the SCO has been held in Tajikistan. This year marked the 20th anniversary of the organization's founding. The Chinese President Xi Jinping called on member states of the SCO to strengthen solidarity and cooperation and build a closer SCO community with a shared future. Yuan was finally approved as a member in his first trip overseas. Ebrahim Raisi welcomed Iran's admission, said that diplomacy is one of the means to ensure national interests of the countries.
Diplomacy is one of the means to ensure national interests of countries. It is efficient when all sides remain committed to their obligations in practice. Threatening and pressuring other sides weaken diplomacy.
When it comes to Iran's membership at the SCO, this comes at a crucial time due to the JCPOA and Iran nuclear talks. Iran's president has said that Iran's economy and economic progress will not be tied to the outcome of the talks if it did not yield the desired results for Iran.
The world is entering a new era with a new order. Domination and unilateralism are on the decline. International order is moving toward multipolarization and redistribution of power in favor of independent states.
Iran has said that the best solution would be to find intra-regional banking and monetary mechanism to help independent countries deflect illegal U.S. sanctions and pave the way for securing free trade by taking advantage of national currencies or by defining a specific currency as a suitable alternative for the U.S. dollar, something that SCO members are doing. The SCO economies, as explained, make up a major portion of the world economy. But the world economy itself, after the pandemic, is changing in terms of which countries are contributing the most to economic output. Now, SCO as a whole makes up around 25% of the world's economic output. And as countries like China, Russia, and India, and even Iran progress economically, which are projected to be the case, the economic output of the East will then eventually outpace the West, in particular the EU and the US. Now let's not forget that Qatar and Saudi Arabia are also being considered for joining the organization, which will expand the organization and world GDP as a consequence. Now both of our guests rejoin us for this final Q&A of the program, Professor Mohamed Marandi. We also have Andre Leung, international and independent China strategist, rejoining us. Professor Marandi, I'm going to first start with you. The SCO countries, in terms of the relevance, in terms of the stats, some of them, one-fourth of the Earth's land, half of the human population. It's a regional organization, the heart of Asia. And in terms of the global GDP, accounting for one-fifth of that. We're looking at Iran to have joined it, a host of countries now, amongst them Russia and China, as you're well aware. Do you think that the economic potential of the SCO has been reached, especially now that Iran has joined it?
Iran's membership in this organization creates an important opportunity for Iran to expand its trade and business and cooperation, both political and economic, with Asian countries. We know that Western countries are on the decline, and the rise of Asia is visible for everyone to see. Iran is critical in West Asia. It is the most important power in Western Asia, so it can contribute a great deal to the integration of the continent as a whole. But also, these countries like China, Russia, and other members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization can help Iran as well to decrease the capabilities to put pressure on Iran. So all these countries need one another, and as Asia rises and as Western countries decline, this is an important and historic moment.
Okay, Andrew Leung, let me turn to you. This is an important point that I'd like to make. In 2017, you had India and Pakistan becoming the official members. Iran is now a member, and the primary goal of this group is to reduce the risk of conflict between SCO member states. At least that was one of their charters. Joining the fight against the three evils, terrorism, extremism, and separation. But you also have this China One Belt project, which connects these countries.
but the U.S. is on a confrontational path with China. Is the U.S. then a threat to these countries and their ambitious economic goals?
Well, I don't think the United States has the appetite or the resources to build as big connectivity projects like the Belt and Road. As far as the, don't forget that India is part of the SCO members, and India and China do not see eye to eye always, but nevertheless is a member of the SCO, and is a, India is not a total ally of the United States either because of this kind of nuanced, non-aligned foreign policy.
Andre Leung speaking there, international independent China strategist, and also like to thank Professor and political analyst Mohamed Morandi, who gave us his thoughts and input into this program on the SCO. At this point, I'll be back in our next segment with my final thoughts. There's no denying it. The SCO is now a relevant organization in the world, from trade to security, i.e. fighting extremists and terrorists, especially when it comes to a country like Afghanistan. Now, this bloc of countries stands smack in the face of the U.S., which wants to pursue China economically and militarily. Countries that are in China's sphere, who have been aided through loans for the execution of China's Belt and Road Initiative, especially countries that have been hit by harsh U.S. sanctions like Iran, will stand in the way of U.S. unilateralism. There are even talks of establishing a new monetary system to bypass the Western-controlled SWIFT banking system, like between Russia and Iran. That does it for this edition of the program. Your questions and comments are always welcome. It was great to have you with us. From Mika Vitale and the entire team, it's goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.